Hey guys, welcome to The Years in Between.
With me, Loretta Maria.
And me, Jacinta Joey.
This is a podcast where we talk about
our thoughts, feelings and experiences in the years in between.
What chapter was the first chapter you got highlights from, me?
Not self-affirmation, self-acceptance.
Oh, we started from the same one.
Yeah, so I highlighted self-affirmation is making suggestions to oneself, such as I can do it or I am strong, even when something is simply beyond one's ability.
You know, when I read that, I was sort of like, because I guess not a lot of the times, but typically when you tell yourself, like, I can do it, it's okay, you can do it, is because you have that slight self-doubt that you need that affirmation.
So you need the, like, boosting of our, Even if you can't do it.
Beyond.
I guess that's a positive way to look at it. Rather than looking at your self-doubt, you're looking at your self-affirmation.
But then when people do self-affirmation, do you think they're doing it from a lens of doubt?
They probably are doing it from a lens of doubt to encourage them to do the thing that they want to do. But I think in all, the fact that they're trying to overcome that doubt is positive, because they could easily, like, would it be self-accept and run away and say that they can't do it?
I guess, maybe.
But then that wouldn't be accepting, that would just be...
In the same way I couldn't do a decathlon, like, a, I don't know, run 10 laps on a thing. It's not a sense of, like, I guess I could if I trained for it, but it's like, I'm accepting of myself enough to know that I'm not about to do that.
Yeah, accepting of yourself. Yeah, at that point, but I think if you took stages to get to that point,
true,
you can do it. So ultimately you can do it,
but I guess it depends on what it is that you're trying to do.
Yeah, I think,
like, like, I was about to say something crazy, but, like, I don't know, like, you know, in, for example, if you, I don't know, if you wish for something that you physically can't have,
that's self-acceptance. So it's more so, I don't have this right now, but
no, I'm saying, like, something like for physically. Example, if I was like, oh, I want to get blue eyes, my natural eyes to be blue.
Oh. Like, I mean, that, unless you're going to go down a fake route and get contact lenses.
Yeah, but it's just like... Yeah.
Okay. But if you, let's say, for example, you with decathlon and running, like, laps. If you can't do that right now, reading the book, the philosopher used the example of self-affirmation would be, I just happened to get unlucky this time around. The real me is 100%.
Yeah. Whereas sort of self denial, to an extent.
Self-acceptance is, okay, I got 60%. How can I get 100%?
What are the steps?
I think self-affirmation can be an element of, like, encouragement, but also, yeah, denial, because you're denying the reality
of what it is. What I think is. Self-affirmation might be the short term, but self-acceptance is definitely long term. I think, like, for example, if you're about to go and do a speech in front of thousands of people and you're beyond nervous and you're literally, like,
then you would need to self-affirm
yourself, you can do it, even though you feel like you can't and you have that doubt that you can't because you're literally nervous to speak in front of all these people,
but you have that long term view of, okay, I was nervous this time around, but how
can I be confident. And that's that, like, self-acceptance and awareness. I guess it's self-awareness as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think affirmation is maybe more short-term, and then self-acceptance is definitely, like, a long-term thing.
I think it's also easy to get caught up in the affirmations of, like, you're looking at everything in a toxic positivity, I think.
How do you mean?
Like, if we use the example of the test and he got 60, I don't know, maybe toxic positivity wasn't the right, but I just happened to get unlucky this time. The real me is 100%, so that wasn't the real you doing the exam. It just feels very, like, fake. And
but I guess it depends. It's case by case. What if they're, to play that devil's advocate, or to play the, I don't like that saying, but to play, like,
the other hand,
there could be other ulterior variables that contribute to the fact that he got 60. What if he was at home and he had younger siblings, you kept annoying him?
So the real you is not, because that is your reality.
Yeah, but I guess if that's his reality, that's his reality. You have to present yourself as the real you, even. But I guess it's something that's a hindrance to, like, it stops your potential.
So you allow other factors to...
But it's not even a sense of allowing other factors to hinder you. It's sort of the reality of your life makes, like, other factors have a hindrance on your performance. Like, but if you have to look after your kids, you have to entertain, not after your kids, if you have to look after your siblings or entertain your siblings when you could be studying, for example, that's a variable that your classmate may not have.
Yeah.
And they could use that time to study.
But how would he know that the real him is getting 100% if that's not reality that he lives?
Because he knows that the time he's spending playing with his siblings, he could be spending studying. And that would allow for maybe practice test questions, or do you know what I mean? Like, obviously sometimes it might be a situation where, like, if you're, like, I don't know, instead you're just outside playing with your friends and you're saying, oh, that's not the real me, like, how do you know if it's the real you? Because you're not actively pursuing that. But if you're a smart person and you do decently well, but it's just the fact that you have other priorities that come before you being able to study per se, I feel like that's a variable that, in saying that's not the real me, could potentially be plausible. But I do see the philosopher's perspective in the sense that you,
it's, I think, better to work. It could be a malleable variable. Like, they could work around that.
That's what I was thinking of, like, in the sense of work, what can I do next time? Can I move, like, would they have to stay up late in the middle of the night?
No, but also I think if that's a reality that that person lives in,
it's unfortunate, I guess.
It is unfortunate, but it is a norm for them, so they would figure ways around it to be able to study and get a good 100% grade.
I guess it's like the saying, like, if they wanted to, they would. Like, if it means that much to you, you would find a way to make it work.
And he does go, I don't know what chapter it is in the book, but he goes in it and says, like, I think it's more of a etiology. Which one's the one that's stuck in the past?
And etiological, I think.
Yeah. So, because of that, because,
like, what happened in the past.
Yeah. Because their life is such a, well, there's variables in their life that causes hindrance. They're going to use that as an excuse to not be able to perform as well as they want to, because they have the excuse anyway, so they're not going to put their 100% effort in. I think he goes into that. I think so.
Oh no, I think mine is in the difference between trust and confidence. That's the next chapter, so if you have any more for the other one.
I just really liked when the youth spoke of a quote from Kurt Vonnegut, and
I highlighted too.
Yeah, it's basically a little prayer, and it reads, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, which is true, because there's some things that we can't, the courage to change things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I love that, because there are things about us that we can't change. There are things about us that we can change. And I think being able to go about life knowing what we can and cannot change provides us with the self-acceptance and allows us to see life in a lens of, like, possibilities and capabilities as well. You're not, like, restricted from your insecurities or other things that you can't,
I guess,
change.
Like, yeah, like I was saying,
there's liberation in that.
Yeah, literally knowing the difference between it all, and again having the courage to do it.
Everything's courage, guys. It seems like there's emphasis on courage.
Bro, 100%. Like, I feel like, what? I guess that's the thing. It doesn't come easy, because if it came easy, everyone would be doing what they truly, truly want to do in life. No one would be out here pretending.
So, this chapter is called, this chapter is the difference between trust and confidence. And yeah, I thought all interesting, like, there's a clear difference between trust and confidence. I guess when you're using it in relation to another person, then there is, like, I think because I can trust you or have confidence in that person to show up, I think they both appear in your life different ways.
I kind of struggled to understand what you meant by the difference. Like, I get that the examples later on, but when you were saying the difference, I was sort of like, I don't get it.
So my first highlight in this chapter is the youth was basically asking the philosopher what does affirmative resignation mean, because he was saying that sounds pessimistic, and the philosopher was kind of saying resignation has the connotation of seeing clearly with fortitude and acceptance, and then that's my highlight, having a firm grasp on the truth of things, that is resignation. There is nothing pessimistic about that. And I think that's where self-acceptance comes in. If you realise that, you know, you put in your best efforts but you can't do anything about it, or you can't push any further, that's when you would resign. But then you would know in yourself that you've done well, and you've gotten to that limit where, you know, I did what I could do and I can't do anything more.
It's above me now.
Yeah. So I think that's an affirmative resignation.
Resignation,
yeah. Which is, yeah.
When I was reading that, I was sort of like, I don't mean, like, it was like that bit was just going over my head, but like, you've explained it really well. Like,
thanks.
Now I'm just like, that's very true, because if it's above you, there's no point, like, literally just now talking to like a wall, you're trying to.
Yeah, because I think you've gone through the stages of like affirming yourself that you can do it, or you have the ability to do it, then you've accepted yourself, where it's just like, okay, I got this far, how can I get further? And probably you got to the end where it's like, okay, so I've got a bit further than my last result, but I can't go any more further. So I'm just gonna resign.
Yeah. I think it is quite hard, I guess, depending on the personality type that a person has, or the characteristics of a person, to know when to stop.
Knowing when to stop is important.
I feel like it is quite hard, because you know sometimes you get that feeling like you can sense that you're like just that bit away from figuring it out, or doing it, or just getting the right thought process to get to where you want to be.
Yeah.
But like you saying, like what you're saying and what the philosopher's saying, I guess there's a point where the cost is just too much. It's not worth all the, I guess, mental strain.
When you were saying that, you know, this is like a classic image or gif, whatever you want to call it. But two miners are on the ground and they're like digging, and there's one that's really close to the diamond but he gives up, and there's one that keeps going but he's really far away. He's close as well. But yeah, I just thought with like the whole resigning thing, what if you're close to the breakthrough? What happens then?
Like, that's the thing that you don't know. That's what people say, like, a jack of all trades but a master of none. But that's also, that quote doesn't really relate, because it's giving, like,
You're doing everything
you can, really, but like, doing? Yeah, it's hard, it's very hard to sort of navigate
that. So like, how do you know your limit? Because let's say that person that was close to the diamonds, he just went one scratch more, he would have achieved his goal of finding that. But like, did he resign? Did he affirm himself, like, you know, I've done what I could, I've come this far? But then also, if you've waited, like my mum used to say, well, we waited for the bus for like 5 minutes, why don't I just wait longer until it comes? Because if you could have walked the distance, but you've waited in that time, just wait. In relation to the picture that I just described, I think the best point for the miners to give up is if they've got to the other side of the tunnel they're digging, and they've not received, like, they've not found anything. I think that's a good point. That's a good start.
What about pivoting?
And going back?
Like, just turning a bit to the left and then going.
Why? Different. I feel like if I was a miner, I didn't mind, and I'd go just straight. Because obviously they'll do their calculations and their estimations to figure, okay, this is where the diamond could possibly be. So let me go with the calculations that I've done.
And sometimes it's a stroke of luck, like, it'll probably obviously calculations, estimations with a pinch of a stroke of luck, I think. Because what if the thing was like 0.1 to the left? You're screwed. The book talks about unconditional confidence in others.
Mm. Oh yeah.
What is your stance on having unconditional confidence in other people?
I think that's where the division of truth, well, is it truth?
Trust.
That's where the division of trust and confidence comes in. I think unconditional trust
mm-hmm.
in others is, my mum always says this, like, just do good on your side, and regardless of what they've done, just know that you've done good.
Mm-hmm.
So I think having that unconditional trust in that person, it's like, regardless of what they do, you're still going to trust them.
Mm-hmm.
Or regardless of how you were in the relationship, you're still going to trust them, forgetting like any other possibilities. Like, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just want to read your highlight and I read what I've got.
So this bit is in relation to unconditional confidence in a relationship and your partner in the relationship. For example, you're in a love relationship, but you are having doubts about your partner, and you think to yourself, I'll bet she's cheating on me. And you start making desperate efforts in search of evidence to prove that. What do you think would happen as a result? The youth says, well, I guess that will depend on the situation. The philosopher says, no, in every instance, you would find an abundance of evidence that she has been cheating on you. The youth says, wait, why is that? And the philosopher says, your partner's casual remarks, her tone when talking to someone on the phone, the times when you can't reach her, as long as you're looking with doubt in your eyes, everything around you will appear to be evidence she's cheating on you, even if she's not. And then a little bit further on, the philosopher says, if you are afraid to have confidence in others, in the long run, you will not be able to build deep relationships with anyone. So I guess in that...
That's quite convicting.
How so?
I mean, I do go off by, like, you trust the person until they show you a reason to trust them, or do you doubt them until you know you can fully trust them?
I would like to say that I'm trusting and then until it's broken, but I feel like I have a slight apprehension. I wouldn't say doubt, I have an apprehension, but then I give trust, and then if it's broken, I'm sort of scared to give it out again. How about you?
Because I feel like I have just recently shifted from doubting them until I know I can trust them, from that mindset mm-hmm. to now, like, trusting them until they show me that I can't trust them anymore. So I feel like it was quite convicting, because I was that person that would look for something to affirm myself, like, yeah, that's why I can't trust you.
Do you know what? I think maybe I am trusting until I am. Trusting until I'm given a reason to.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're saying about, like, how you're saying you're looking for things, I don't think I look. I never look until
a situation
arises where it's like.
Nah, I used to. I'm gonna say I used to. I used to be like, that's very odd that you do that. Why do you do that? And yeah, I think going about life testing people to know whether you can trust them or not is really, like, as the philosopher said, you wouldn't be able to build deep connections because you're always in doubt with other people. And I think that's just not a place where I would want to reside.
I think that's mentally. Yeah, I think if anything, if somebody's like that, I feel like I'd see it from a lens of they're just trying to protect themselves.
Yeah, you can protect yourself, but you're barricading yourself.
And, like, I guess you're closing in.
And I guess you're rejecting yourself from your community.
Exactly. Like, yeah, you're not allowing yourself to have, like, yeah. It says deep.
And I think it's like self. Can I say self-indulgence? I don't know. Or self-promoting. Like, you feel like you're the only person that you can trust in this world, and everyone else is like up against you, which is like wrong, because
that's really interesting. I feel like that's really valid, that's really true, because why you, that's out of all people, that's to, like, so sure that you're the only person,
That's a characteristic of the spirit of Jezebel, actually, isn't it?
Really?
Self-promotion, self-control. But yeah, so on the same chapter, I highlighted a bit where the philosopher said, if I were to have confidence in someone unconditionally, I would just get taken advantage of. However, you are not the one who decides whether or not to take advantage. That is the other person's task. Okay, so he's explaining what it means to, I guess, he was breaking down what it means to really unconditionally trust in someone or have confidence in someone. Mm-hmm. And he's just saying to the youth, like, that's not your obligation to know whether you're going to be taken advantage of or not. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the unconditional comes into play, where it's like, regardless how you are in the relationship, or regardless of,
it's on them, choose that they want to manipulate you and
or not. And that's what goes back when I said earlier, like, my mum always just says, like, just do good on your part, and regardless if they do or they don't, you know that you've done good.
Mm.
You know that you've done right by yourself. To yourself, sorry.
That's so true.
So it's like, yeah, I think that's so interesting.
That releases a burden, though.
It does, because you're not taking on the other person's task, like,
yeah.
And you're not making sure that they're doing right by you.
Mm-hmm.
You're not making sure that you're not getting it.
Taken advantage of. Not,
yeah.
I think that also reinforces that you have to take it. Some things you just have to take at face value. Like, you can't constantly feel like, like I was saying, like, you can't constantly be, I guess, fearful, like, read into things too much, because at the end of the day, like, if they want to abuse your trust, they're going to do it. And like how you're saying, your mum says, you're going to feel, like, you're good. If you show up as that person, then you're not going to eat on your conscience.
Exactly. And at the end of the day, when two people come together as one, like, we are family, but yet we live very different, separate lives.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, your morals, they may be the same as mine, they may be different, but when we come in partnership or relationship with each other, it's like we're bringing our two worlds together, our two morals together. So you might see life in a different lens and I will see it in a different lens, but it's like, if we both do right by to ourselves, I think we're doing right for the relationship.
That's so true.
Because if we take advantage of each other, then we're not doing right for each other or for the two of us. Mm. Because now we have extra burdens, like, okay,
they're just draining each other.
Yeah, exactly. The wretch is now going to do this, and I now have to do this to kind of pay her back or to make sure that she doesn't one up me in this way. Mm. And I think that just sounds like a shoulder of
burdens. Yeah, you really ate with that one. Wow.
And there's also, it brings a, like, understanding as well.
Mm.
Because you would then explain why you do certain things, and I would then explain why I do certain things. But then it's like, okay, she does it like that, I do like this. Where's the common ground? Or, like, how could we
meet in the middle and compromise?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Ultimately, love is sacrifice, and it's unconditional. There is unconditional risk in loving someone else.
Yeah. The chapter is called The Essence. Oh, have you finished all your highlights from the movie?
Yeah.
The essence of work is a contribution to the common good. The youth says, and I quote, "It is true that people seek the sense of belonging, that, quote, it's okay to be here, close quote. And to get that, they need self-acceptance and confidence in others. But can one really gain a sense of belonging just by seeing others as comrades and having confidence in them?" So essentially, at this point, the philosopher is saying that the idea, what's the chapter called then? The idea of giving to the... Yeah, the idea of the essence of work is a contribution to the common good, is that we have to see everyone as comrades.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when we're doing something, even if it's like, quote unquote, you wouldn't want to do it, if you view it as like, we're doing it for the collective good, these are my comrades, we're all trying to work towards something, it makes it so that carrying out tasks that may be arduous or laborious, whatever, you have a purpose and a meaning because you're contributing. You feel like you're of use to society, and in doing so and in having that, your existence makes it so that you're happy because you have purpose and you give contribution. But then you feel like, oh, isn't that not just living for the recognition of others because you're serving others, essentially?
Yeah.
But then the philosopher was like, oh no, if you're doing that in a way for recognition for others, you're going to end up living a life where you're just doing what other people's wishes are, rather than being authentic and living within yourself. But the way he was describing it was like,
they're working as a team.
Yeah, you're working as a team to
together.
But then he uses an example about a mum, and like how, for example, in like a traditional household, if you think, I'm saying traditional household, I don't know what a traditional household is today, but I'm saying, for example, I was going to say like, oh, the woman cooks and then cleans up after everyone.
I thought you were going to say someone else. Yeah, I guess women are now stepping into men's fields, as they like to call it. Yeah, I guess a normal nuclear household would be that.
But she, because she was saying, like, for example, if a mum cooks all the food, the kids eat, obviously the husband's come back from work, he eats whatever, and then the mum cleans up the table and everything, and she may not hear a thank you, but in that instance, in that such a situation, because she's doing something for others and she's contributing and seeing her family as comrades rather than like enemies, where it's like, oh, I have to clean up after you, but she's seeing it as like, oh, like, I've made food that they've enjoyed and that they've ate and that they've
I fulfilled my purpose.
Yeah, like, I've provided them with something that they now feel nourished, for example. My comrades feel nourished. Like, he was saying it from a lens, like, she has a, like, saying purpose, and she's giving to the common good of the family, community.
That sounds a bit depressing, though.
Why do you think?
Like, if that's, like, a reality for someone, I respect that you are seeing your family as a comrade that you're fulfilling purpose in.
But you were just saying it in general, that was just an example of something.
I know, but with some people that's just their life, like, they don't get the recognition that they deserve. So if they view it in that positive light, then that helps them. But also, if that makes them happy, that makes them happy.
Do you think, like, a mother who would then view her contribution to others in service, but her contribution to the family community being like cooking whatever, and how you're saying that's a bit like depressive, what do you say, like, it's a,
for some, I think for me it would be depressive.
Do you feel like it's because it's like,
maybe not, because I don't have kids, again, like, I don't have a family that I'm caring for,
because if it's my baby,
yeah, if it's my, that's the thing, like, I don't think my opinion has such weight, because that's not a life I
live right now to know.
I think if we were to ask for the from the perspective of our mothers, then it would be different. Like, they would probably feel satisfied and fulfilled from doing that for us.
This was the actual section where he talks about it. So he says, it's dinner at home, there are still dishes left on the table. The children have gone off to their rooms and the husband is sitting on the sofa watching television. It's been left to the wife, me, to do the dishes and clear everything up. To make matters worse, the family takes that for granted and they don't make the slightest effort to
help.
Does
that not sound depressive?
Yeah, that's...
to make matters worse?
In such a situation, normally one would think, why won't they give me a hand, or why do I have to do all the work?
And facts.
Even if I do not hear the words thank you from my family while even if I don't hear the words thank you from my family while I'm cleaning up, I want them to think that I'm of use to the family. Instead of thinking about what others can do for me, I want to think about and put into practice what can I do for other people. Just by having the feeling of contribution, the reality right in front of me will take on a completely different hue. So basically, when I'm cleaning up after everyone, I'm meant to be like,
what can I do? What can
I? I made the food.
That's very uncomfortable. That's very uncomfortable to even think that some women go through that.
I don't know about that giving, one philosopher.
Yeah, it's giving maid.
Yeah.
Or maybe we're just not looking at it the way that he went.
Because then he goes on to say, if I'm humming away to myself and washing the dishes in good spirit, the children might come and give me a hand. But what if they don't?
Was he tired writing that bit? Because I'm feeling a sense of...
And it's like, at least... I'd be creating an atmosphere in which it's easier for them to offer their help. If you don't pick up your plate and go... the philosopher says, in other words, to be self-reliant and the conscience that I have the ability correspond to our discussion of self-acceptance, and then to live in harmony with society and the conscience that people are my comrades, connect to confidence in others, and then to contribution to others. The idea that we have to view everyone as comrades in order to live in harmony. So, like how you're saying about the mum,
mm-hmm.
if she views her family as comrades, that is the way that they will live in harmony, because ain't nobody helping her. So I guess in that context, to live in harmony, she has to view them as comrades.
Seeing her children as comrades.
In order to be in harmony in that instance, not literally. I feel like from the perspective,
why can't she vocalize that she feels used?
I know my S professor. I just think
that was a poor example that he could have used. Okay, so the next chapter that we're going to discuss further is workaholism is a lifeline, and in this chapter, the philosopher talks about how someone that stammers.
He's a stammer, I said, wait, what? Sorry, carry on.
Someone that stammers sees life in a victimized way.
Yeah, and that example was a bit...
victimized way, but yeah, that example was a bit like question mark. But also, I feel like, I guess it was another feeling of conviction, but I felt that when he said... people that stammer, it's because they think about the way that they communicate and speak that causes them to doubt the way that they speak, so they stutter in their speech.
I remember reading that, yeah.
And I felt like, wow, that's not even raw, but I just felt like, that kind of hits home with me, because I do think about the way that I speak, and I feel like this ain't a pity party. But sometimes I feel like I can come across as quite illiterate, because I don't take confidence in my speech. Yeah, so I kind of get what he means by that example.
I hear that, but not like here isn't that you sound illiterate, but like I hear it in the sense, well, from on my perspective, I feel like it's not a sense of like it's a lack of trusting what I'm going to say, so I just don't say it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like sometimes when I'm trying to say things, I'll be like, my head's going fast. I'm like, you know what? Like, it's fine. Like, never mind. Like, I can't articulate what it is I'm trying to say.
Yeah. I can articulate better like texting or like
writing,
but like with like verbal speech, it's just that the words get taken away from me, or like my mind goes blank.
No, but I don't think you give yourself enough credit.
No, I listen to myself back again. I'm just like, what were you
but saying? I don't think you realised how much you ate when you said that to him this not too long ago. I said,
I guess also when you feel like you have confidence in what you're saying, you don't really overthink about what you are saying.
Mm-hmm.
But when you feel like you don't have much knowledge in what you're saying, that's when the doubt comes into play and infringes on your speech. So yeah, I also heard the other day that when people lack confidence in what they're saying, they like their tone of voice goes like quieter, or the volume goes quieter.
I feel like people say "I think" more.
Yeah, they say "I think." They do say "I think," but also like, let's say you ask me, I'm trying to think of an example. I don't know. Let's say you're at work and you ask me like, "Oh, what's this like string of code?" And I'm just like, obviously, I don't know code like that, so I'm just going to say what I do. It's going to be like, oh, this is a a loop. You ask me about something that I do know, like, oh, what's the weather like tomorrow? And I'm like, oh, it's gonna rain tomorrow.
Mm.
Like, there's you can tell the level of confidence someone has in their answer by this, the volume of speech.
That's true. I do think so. But some people, I guess, some people also just have quiet voices. But I do agree.
I have quiet voices. But also, when I know when I'm not sure of my answer, and I know when I am. And that men scratch the back of their heads
when they're unsure.
When they're unsure, when they're lying.
Being audacious. But I think also for me personally, obviously sometimes it could be for a lack of knowledge. But then also, I think for me, it comes when it's like, I'm hyper aware of how the person may receive what I'm going to say.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? So I'm like running through different ways of saying things so I can almost anticipate how they're going to react and just tailor it so it's like the least. It not necessarily to be something bad, but like the least like extravagant of a reaction. I feel like that's also a reason why sometimes I mean like struggle to articulate, because it's like I'm not trying to start no chaos.
Yeah,
you know? So
I do.
But I don't think that's a way to be, and that's not a good way to communicate, because it's like you can't go through life, I guess, like literally, but you can't go through life pleasing others. And it's not to please others, just because I just don't want to, like, I don't want to hurt someone's feelings. But that's also disliked, but it's not because I don't want to be, like, liked by people. It's a weird one, I don't know.
I guess you think of yourself in their shoes of too much.
Yeah, I think, like, empathy.
How would you like to be, how would you like whatever you're saying to be communicated to you, because if you received it in a different way, you may respond.
Yeah, but I do it to the point where then I'm just like, you know what, it's okay. I'd rather not say it. Like, there's just too much wahala for them.
But there's release in saying it.
Mm-hmm. I agree, definitely. But like I said, it's a work in progress, guys.
It is.
But in relation to the workaholism is a lie, the stammer example was like a bad example that the youth said, and that's when they went into workaholism is a lie.
Mm.
And then I think this relates to when I read it, I was like, oh, sounds familiar. Reference to myself, I guess. He talks about how when people use the idea of work as an excuse to not show up in their other lifestyles, yeah, it means that they're not living in harmony. So like, you know how some people
there's a disconnect.
Like if you find like where people are like, oh, I don't know, can't come to your show, have to work 4 hours later after whatever, like work's over, it's just sort of like you're like giving up your other life tasks of friendship or family, whatever, love, because of work. But it's all about, it's like, you know, people say work-life balance, but then some people say there's no such thing as work-life balance. Do you think there is such thing as work-life balance?
I think it's what you make it. If you are so consumed by your work, of course, then you're not going to have a work-life balance.
Mm.
If you lack responsibility in other aspects of your life, you're not going to have a work-life balance. So I think, yeah, it just depends on what you make it.
But then, you know how some people say while you're young, you should grind now, and then you can, like, chill later, per se.
But then,
you know how if you then grind while you're young, and then as you get older, then you want to, like, go into other parts of your, like, other life tasks. But it's like, well,
you lose out.
Yeah, you lose out. What do you think?
I think whilst you're grinding, you should also see the importance of rest and enjoyment. Because you can grind and be so consumed by, again, work that just takes over your life, where you neglect yourself and your other needs. Obviously there's monetary gain in like working, and you have like financial like comfortability, but at what cost does that come with your happiness as well?
What's that Drake, you don't listen to Drake anymore, but it's like, no, it's J. Cole, it's like, what's the point of having like a big, like, you know, Love Yours, the song?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, as long as the people in that house that you have love you dearly, like, that's all that matters. Like, you can have the big house, you can have the like nice car, but if you don't have your people that you want to share it with, that you want to enjoy it with,
well, if you're not like, getting to like, if you're not taking on the relation, is it friendship, family task, love, relationship task, if you're not taking that upon, like, in this life you need to have favor with men, you need to be around people, you can't do this life alone. So I think to really be consumed by like working, I don't know,
you lose out the imbalance, I feel,
because you can't, you won't be able to die with it.
I feel like it, and also, as perspectives that you can pour into life differently.
Yeah.
Like, if all you know is work and all you breathe is work,
you need to intentionally put in your calendar days of rest or days of just, I'm going to enjoy today, or I'm going to spend time with my family. Like, you have the ability and the power to do so, so why not do it? Your work does not control your life. And what's the goal in you working so much?
Literally, when you said that, it reminded me of the other quote where it's literally like, it talks about a father and how like,
yeah, he just comes home.
Yeah, he's a breadwinner.
His goal is like to, yeah, to boast that he's the breadwinner.
Yeah, but also, there comes a point in life where you will no longer be able to be the breadwinner.
And there's a broken interpersonal relationship with yourself because you've disconnected
from you're lonely. Side.
Yeah.
All the other life tasks aren't there. You haven't got any hobbies. Like, work isn't just bringing in money. Like, the philosopher then mentions, like, work being, like, hobbies or, like, just different, like, company work is just one small aspect of the greater examples of work.
Yeah.
But it's, like, I guess it's work in your life, like, work in your relationship, work in your friendships, work in your family, work in your work. Like, there's many avenues in which, I guess, we have to balance, but...
Yeah. I feel like if you have a list of priorities and what comes first, or you know what you're going to prioritize that week or in that month or that season of your life, I think that's where like a what, like somewhat spread evenly balance comes in. May not be a good balance, but if you know that you have your hand the different aspects of your life as much as you possibly can in that time, and you're doing what you can.
Yeah, we'll never all be entirely equal, I don't think.
Yeah, exactly. There's some times where, like in a relationship, sometimes you're like 70% and I might be 30, and vice versa. We just have to learn how to
balance it and like compensate for each other.
I don't think balance is ever 50-50.
Yeah, that's what, like, is there such thing as work-life balance? Like, not every avenue of your life will be aligned perfect. If it is, the quote is, but if one is lacking in harmony of life, one will always focus on that person and end up thinking everyone is laughing at me. That person being, oh yeah, he was talking about the idea. Did you see, read the thing about Judaism?
Yeah.
And yeah. So there was, he was saying like, oh, in Judaism, there's this belief where it's like, oh, you have one person that doesn't like you.
Yeah.
And then you can have two people that like you and agree with you.
A group of 10 people, one person does not like you.
Yeah.
Two people will love you. And the other seven will just like...
are indifferent towards you.
Yeah.
But in Judaism...
they will focus on the people. One person.
No. In Judaism, they focus on the people that they agree with. So there's, they believe that there's no point putting your energy towards a person that dislikes you. Put it towards the people that you that agree and like you, because what's the point living in a life constantly going against someone because you're not living in harmony? Yeah, I guess it's just the idea that really in life, just choose what brings you peace. Water waters you, really. Like,
water waters you.
Yeah, there's no point in going through life screaming and shouting because life's hard already. Okay, so the last chapter in the book is called
The Greatest Life Lie.
And the philosopher essentially says that life is what you make it, like life is whatever the individual makes of it. And the idea that Well, he then talks about his grandfather. He says, my grandfather chose a lifestyle with the perspective of people are my comrades and the world is a beautiful place. That is exactly what Adler's pointing to when he says, whatever meaning life has must be assigned to it by the individual. You are the only one who can assign meaning to your life. So even though in this example, the grandfather got his face burned or something like that.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
He still went about life. He saw people as good people and he chose to do that. Another person may have like become a recluse and hid away because of their physical features, but it's the meaning in which you give to life. Like, there's no secret, because the youth starts looking for like answers. Like, do you think there's like a secret meaning to life, like a secret answer to life, like what life is?
My meaning to life would be, you probably know the answer to this,
mm-hmm.
but it's to fulfill the purpose that the Lord has given you. To me, the meaning of life is to, I would agree with the philosopher, like to live in harmony with others and to fulfill the purpose on, to fulfill my purpose here on earth, and also to give back when I can, be loving, be encouraging. So I think the meaning of life is really just pursuing, like,
I think it's pursuing authenticity and genuineness and being true to yourself.
I was gonna say pursuing the Lord.
I think that's also that's like a valid thing, like,
yeah, because in that you find more of yourself and you establish your calling, and if you seek the Lord and you follow in obedience, then you will fulfill your purpose.
And I guess you won't feel lost.
Life. Of course, like, you have like human feeling, emotions, but Jesus also had the same.
There's comfort in that, isn't there?
Exactly. So
comfort.
Yeah. The meaning to one's life will be individualistic.
Yeah, and I feel like it's just, again, I guess it's the courage to be you and stand by that and show up as that version of yourself.
Always. Every day. So, do you have the courage to be disliked?
Yeah, I feel like over the course of... You've
been equipped.
I feel like, yeah, and I feel like this book has...
Yeah.
Yeah. I think this book has really...
Enforced that.
Yeah, a lot of the youth's thoughts I think I did have,
what
I possess, and then hearing what the philosopher said on them and spoke on them.
The flip side.
Is really made me go, that's an interesting perspective on it. What did you, do you think you have the courage to be disliked?
Yeah, I think likewise, I did have the same sort of responses and thoughts as the youth, but with like the understanding of like Alderian psychology and just like breaking things down and to seeing things as tasks and seeing people's goals and that their behaviour or like the expression of emotions.
I think the tasks one's a really cool one to look at.
Like, yeah, that's really helped me. Like, I've been able to...
And separating tasks for me personally, I think it's really important.
Having the wisdom and knowing that what's my task and what's yours, and again having that separation. So yeah, it's definitely like helped me, especially with how like others may perceive me. It's not like I don't really care as much, but
this is their life task.
Yeah, that's theirs,
not ours.
And mine is to live in courage and be happy. The Bible does say to be bold and courageous, so who said it first? The Lord.
Amen. Well, that's it, guys. That is the courage to be disliked. Excuse if it's a bit, I don't know how this edit's going to come out, because we are tired.
We are.
It's early hours of the morning when we're recording this.
And we've got work tomorrow.
So, yeah, guys. Hope you've enjoyed this book. We hope that you've liked this season of, you know, the courage of being disliked and what that's brought to the table and discussions.
We hope that it's helped you to be disliked. stay tuned for the next season. Not to say that we're going on a break. We'll literally be back like next week.
Exactly.
But we have a new book and we can't wait to like dive into the book together.
We hope you can't wait either.
Yeah.
Don't forget to like, share, comment and subscribe.
Please do leave a review for our audio listeners. Please do rate us 5 stars. I'm not going to get into the technical ways of it.
You guys know the drill.
You guys know the drill, exactly.
And we'll see you next time. Bye, guys.